Good morning. I'd like to call to order the House Interim Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water, or as we call it, EW. And I hate to start our meeting on such a testy note, but I want to go on record so that the legislative administration, I hope, is listening. When I'm told as chair today that this meeting will start at 8, I want it to start at 8. We were locked out till 8:30. If this happens again, I am going to step down as co-chair. And I mean it. All right. Thank you all for coming. I'm sorry about the mix-up. And we have some three very interesting items to work on today. I'm going to switch the order, if you all would just bear with me for a moment, because we are going to handle some business, a work session on the introduction of committee legislative concepts. So with that, I will open a work session on the introduction of committee legislative concepts. And I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC 846, dated July 30th, 2012. LC 934, dated September 25th, 2012. LC 955, dated October 15th, 2012. LC 1069, dated September 10th, 2012. LC 1993, dated October 24th, 2012. LC 2199, dated November 19th, 2012. LC 2712, dated November 30th, 2012.
Thank you. Representative Boone has moved that the following bills be introduced as committee bills for this committee. LC 846, July 30, 2012. LC 934, September 25th, 2012. LC 955, October 15, 2012. LC 1069, September 10, 2012, LC 1993, October 24th, 2012, and LC 2199, dated November 19, 2012. Finally, LC 2712, dated November 12, 2012. Before we have any discussion, I just want to remind everyone of the standard sort of disclaimer. You all know that your vote on this does not indicate either way that you will support the bill when it goes through its final sort of rendition in the next session. However, that it is being considered as a committee measure. So with that little disclaimer, is that all I need to say on that, Beth?
Mm-hmm. We have a question, Mr. Chair.
Any questions? Representative Kenny Guy?
Could you repeat the date on LC 934?
No.
December 25th, 2012.
What did I say?
It's November 30th.
Did I say September?
No, you said November 12th. I thought I said December 25th.
Oh.
But he's getting eager.
just to be clear, and I thank you for the question.
Just laugh.
November 30th. Thank you. Other questions? Seeing none, is there any objection to these bills being considered as the concepts for this committee? Seeing none, then this measure, it's not a measure, is it?
Motion.
Measures are introduced as committee bills.
Then the measures are introduced as committee bills. Done. Thank you for bearing with us.
Would it be appropriate to have a motion to stand down until we get Representative Bailey here to chair the committee?
You'll have enough of that in the next session. So with that, I'm going to again call on Representative Boone to help us with our first item on the agenda, the solar siding work group. And I don't know if you're going to stay with us.
I'm going to go down and have my able-bodied buddies come with me. Because I have two elbows, I'll have two people with me, Todd Burnett and Bart Martin. Are they in the room?
Please come forward.
Okay. One gets elbow left, one gets elbow right. For the record, Representative Deborah Boone from House District 32, the beautiful upper left coast of our state. Thank you for this opportunity to report on the outcome of the solar siding work group. After I make a few comments, there are some members of the work group here who would like to speak. And as you may recall, this work group focused its discussion on two subjects, the wildlife standard and the statutory jurisdictional trigger that directs the project through either a local land use process or state permitting by the Energy Facility Siting Council. The first work group held its final meeting, the full work group, on November 27th. At that meeting, the group reviewed the work products from its two subcommittees. I'd like to briefly review with you the recommendations of the work with the assistance of the agency staff who participated in this process, which was Beth. And you don't have to come down here, though. First, on the jurisdictional trigger, Todd Cornett, who's Division Administrator of Energy Facility Siting for the Department of Energy, is going to explain the current conflict in the statutes and the alternatives discussed by the work groups.
Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Todd Cornett. I'm the Siting Division Administrator for the Oregon Department of Energy, and I was requested to give you a little bit of background on the issue. I believe you have the straw man, was that handed out?
No.
The straw man wasn't handed out. All right, so the soul of the issue is that the statutory definition for energy facilities acts as the trigger. So each of the various energy facilities that are listed in that definition either have a megawatt or an acreage threshold, and that acts as the jurisdictional trigger between the local jurisdictions and the Energy Facility Siting Council. Most of the facilities have a single kind of entry. For solar, there are two entries. One entry is 100 acres, and the other is 105 megawatts. So just to give you a little understanding, for 100 acres, that is equivalent to about between 10 and 20 megawatts, and 105 megawatts is between 500 and 1,000 acres. So there's a pretty big difference in terms of, you know, what happens. Research has not determined any kind of legislative intent behind those two. There is some discussion about one being intended to be for concentrating solar or solar thermal, and the other being for photovoltaics. And I did provide Beth with just a brief kind of overview of what the difference is between concentrating solar and solar photovoltaics, just in case anybody didn't have an understanding of that. And the concentrating solar, you can see by the definition, it uses mirrors or lenses to direct light to a central location. That generates heat and steam, which then runs a turbine. So it kind of acts like a typical type of energy facility with the turbine. On the opposite side is a typical solar facility, which converts the solar to electricity by use of the panels. So they're different concepts. Acreages are about the same in terms of the megawatts per acreage. The big difference being is, you know, the type of facility, and with the concentrating solar, you would also have a facility that almost like a gas plant that has the turbines associated with that as well. So that's really the distinction between these two. So we don't have, again, going back to the legislative intent, is any determination on whether the 100 acre or the 105 megawatt was intended to be for one or the other. And lacking that legislative intent, the trigger is effectively the 100 acre. So the 105 megawatt, you're never going to reach the 105 megawatt if it's kind of at the low end, about 500 acres. So right now, effectively, the 100 acres is the trigger for the Energy Facility Siting Council from the local jurisdiction. So the kind of the current landscape and the future landscape of what we see now, and you'll probably hear some more of this from the industry, is for concentrating solar. There doesn't seem to be any on the landscape in the future. We certainly don't have any out there right now. For solar PV, there are several projects that have been permitted at the local level. These are in the 5 megawatt range, so they're about 25 to 50 acres in size, so they haven't reached the level of that 100 acre jurisdictional trigger. There are possible projects out there that would exceed the 100 acres, and so that's the kind of the question what we're dealing with now is how do we resolve this issue in the short term? The long term is this is definitely one of the items that's listed in the governor's 10-year energy plan to look at all of the renewable energy jurisdictional triggers, and this would be one of those, but that would take a longer effort. And so this subgroup was intended to be kind of a short-term fix and evaluation of this. And so what we ended up working on, at least the jurisdictional piece, was we had more agreement than disagreement, but unfortunately that did not resolve the matter. So there was general consensus on several of the things. There was no actual vote, but generally around the room, most people were kind of in agreement with this. And first was that looking at the concentrating solar, because that's not likely to happen, that we would take that and put that in under the definition, the energy facility definition under thermal, which is a 25 megawatt threshold. We didn't evaluate it too much. There was nobody at the table advocating for thermal, and so that seemed to be a reasonable place to put that, and everybody seemed to be in agreement on that. That would divorce the two, and so there wouldn't be any question about the inconsistency, at least on those two. The second issue where there's agreement was on the solar photovoltaic, that because it's really a footprint impact, that an acreage threshold was the appropriate threshold versus a megawatt threshold. So everybody was largely in agreement on that. And where we couldn't come to an agreement in the short term is what that acreage threshold should be. So that's kind of where we ended it in terms of not being able to move forward. We did agree that it was the right group of people, the right representatives in the room, and that even though we weren't able to come up with a specific acreage agreement, that we should continue working, the group should continue working to either come up with a better acreage threshold, single acreage threshold, or that one of the possibilities was to generate a multiple acre threshold based upon the specifics on the ground. This would be evaluating the specifics of whether there was high-value farmland versus low-value farmland, whether there was natural resource, high-value natural resource issues. So the more significant the specifics on the ground, the lower the acreage threshold would be to the Energy Facility Siting Council, and the kind of the lower the issues on the ground, then the greater the acreage would be for local jurisdictional review of the projects. So that was essentially what we kind of ended with. And I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Any questions from the committee?
Well, Representative Kinniger. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious more about the areas of conflict on the acreage itself, and you started pointing toward like a tiered system that you might have, and that the decisions might be made locally. Is that right? So I'd just love to hear a little bit more about that, where the areas of conflict are in terms of expanding that siting acreage.
Chair, Representative.
Decision making is suggested to take, where are you suggesting it takes place? If it's based on local, does that mean more local decision making within a framework that's set by the state?
Chair, Representative, that was in terms of the future kind of evaluation, that's why it would take much more time and discussion to kind of figure out exactly how that would work. You know, as I said, you know, we'd be looking at multiple acreage triggers. In southeastern Oregon, at least where we're seeing the interest in these right now, there's not a lot of high-value farmland. There may or may not be natural resource interests, but, having a very large acreage in that area probably makes sense based on the specifics on the ground. That would be very different, say, than in the Willamette Valley or, an area of some significant natural resource that's identified by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife or the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The difficulty will be kind of going through that process and working and figuring out what those triggers should be and what those acreages should be.
Representative Thompson.
Why wouldn't it make sense to use a large acreage footprint, declare to the world we're open for solar? I can't imagine a company coming in here and buying 25 acres of high-value farmland to put in a solar array. It doesn't pencil out. or Ocean View property in Representative Boone's district for a solar array. There's no way that would ever pencil out. But yet, at the same time, if we turned all of Representative Benz's district into a solar array, who would care, you know? It seems to me when we put these limitations on, we're sending a clear signal to people developing the industry that we really aren't sure we want them here. And a 2,500 acre or something like that would tell the world we're serious about solar power if they want to come here. And I would bet you anything that size of an array would immediately end up east of the mountains. 5,000 acres, probably that's not realistic in terms of who's going to do that in the first place. But I'd like to see this opened up to where we are making a statement that we're serious about opportunities to do something in this arena. And besides that, Representative Benz needs the economic development desperately.
Mr. Chair.
Seeing no other questions. Representative Benz.
Thank you. I fear that Representative Thompson's remark about no one carrying it, really, would anybody notice? That's the question. there's 19 million acres in my district, and so the thought that 100 acres drives this is really sad. It's just embarrassing, actually. So Representative Thompson's remarks are well taken. If we had a 19 million acre solar array, we'd pretty much supply the energy to the world, I think.
Yeah.
If we had a 1,000 acres, actually, I'm challenged with how to convey the sense of space. One of the things I came up with was the number of 100 acre parcels in just one of my counties. It's 56,000. 56,000 100 acre parcels in one of my five counties. And so it should be embarrassing in these discussions. It just embarrassing. And I appreciate your efforts. I truly do. But it's almost like using a binoculars in the reverse and looking through it and saying, gee, what a small little area you've got. And then focusing on that 100 acres as though it's the last 100 acres in the universe. It's really pathetic. And I mentioned a number of times that what I see happening is this kind of feudal system imposed upon Eastern Oregon by virtue of these restrictions. This kind of, we're going to lock you into where you are, we're going to keep you there because we enjoy it so much. We don't come over there ever. We wouldn't notice we paved you over with solar panels, but we're going to keep you locked into where you are. And that has to change, because it's got to change for so many reasons. But the challenge for us in this forthcoming session is to figure out a way of affecting that change and overcoming this unfortunate application of minutia to areas that are so huge. Ninth largest state in the nation. Ninth largest. We stretch almost from the Pacific Ocean to the foot of the Rocky Mountains, and for some reason we think we're out of land. It's ridiculous and it's embarrassing. But I appreciate your efforts, and I hope we can build on them in the oncoming session.
Representative Benz, we tease you all the time about being from over there, but it's a huge divide. And I guess I want you to comment on Representative Benz's comment, but was there discussion, and this has been a long process, but was there some discussion, and is it possible to discuss this with regional triggers? It makes sense for the scale that our good friend's talking about versus the Willamette Valley.
Chair Gillum, we didn't specifically talk about that, but that was sort of, I think, in the long run, the evaluation of trying to find the right-sized jurisdictional trigger for the specifics on the ground, whether that's regionally based, whether that's based upon soils, whether that's based upon natural resources. Certainly, you know, we do not want to be a barrier to solar development, and we want to incentivize the ability to do solar development in those areas that make sense for them. And at this point, we have a one-size-fits-all. In most instances, the one-size-fits-all thresholds, you know, rarely are the right ones on the ground. And so that's the long-term goal, is to try to find, or at least one of the options, is try to find, you know, triggers that make sense for the specifics on the ground.
I have One more question that might be answered by the next speaker, just the time frame for the decision-making. What are the next steps? And
everybody's looking at me. And I will defer to my cohorts here, or Beth, on that one, to be fair to the committee. Otherwise, I'd be making something up.
Please, Beth. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's really up to you. The group has expressed a lot of interest in continuing to talk about this issue and in resolving it so that there's satisfaction all the way around. They didn't come to an agreement in time to get something into an early 2013 bill. I think there was a sense that more discussion was the right way to go. I think they'd be willing to continue to meet, but it's we're sort of wrapping up the interim work right now, and it's up to you what you'd like to do next.
And I'm glad you asked the question, because the Jules is going to be key to Representative Bailey. Chair Bailey is going to be key to this. And I will say that I was pleased that he agreed with me on the list of the things we read off without saying what they were. One of the LC drafts is 2199, just to hold a placeholder on this subject in case we need it. I hesitate to go into my disappointment over the long haul we've been here, when I've got three people who are representing a work group who did just that, more work, and who sat down in good faith and are still trying to work this out. So I don't mean any disrespect to what was presented or what you've done, but this has been a very long road to get there. I think we all know we don't like to just do everything from here and run it upstairs and run it over to the Senate. If people of goodwill can sit down and do it, great. But this one is stretching my patience. I particularly want our agencies to come to the table and find solutions. And I do appreciate what you, on behalf of the Department of Energy, has said this morning. This is a good part of a piece of it. This was extremely helpful, this alone. But we're not there yet. So that's why we have the placeholder. And I'm hoping we don't have to do a bill, but I think, you know, I would advocate with the chair of this committee for the next session that we need to keep the pressure on and say, either we got to get this worked out or not. And I think the biggest issue is the issue that we all are aware of, the great divide between, you know, one side of the state and the other. Representative Boone has been one of the great advocates of the coast. I've learned more about the unique needs of the coast from you than anybody else in your work on the Coastal Caucus. But we can't ignore the other side of the state, particularly when it's something that has so much potential. And I think maybe we ought to all just meet over there for a session. You know, move the capital to Ontario for a session so that we can be there and see the kind of scale. I mean, are you listening to the kind of acreage we're talking about? I have a huge district. I go almost from Silverton to Mount Hood, and it's not very big when I hear the numbers that my friend here is talking about. We need to make this work for different parts of the state. I'll stop my speech with that and say again, I appreciate it, but we need to move forward, and I hope the committee and those of us who are still on the committee won't let this go and either move forward with a bill or come to final agreement with the work group. If there are other comments, I'm welcome. I welcome Representative Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I agree with you, and I am in particular agreement with Representative Thompson's earlier comments about opening Oregon up for solar energy development. We made a conscious decision that this is an appropriate energy for future development in this state, but at every turn, we crimp the style of those who would come in and develop that industry. And making it such that scale becomes, in many instances, uneconomic, has a direct impact on the cost that ratepayers pay. And so we continue to disrupt the market's ability to develop itself, and it has many, many costs. And I think we need to free the industry, as Representative Thompson said earlier.
Yeah, Representative Thompson.
I strongly recommend that we develop a bill on this, and I think we got good bipartisan support on it, and drive a stake in the ground. I mean, and we do this repeatedly. We talk about creating jobs in Oregon, creating technology in Oregon, and then we do something really stupid that says we're really not open to your concept. You know, I don't see what the limitation is in opening this up. The economics say the solar industry is not going to move in here and buy the most expensive land in the state for a solar array. They're going to buy the least expensive because that pencils out. And why do we want to hobble them? I mean, let's open this thing up. If they want to do 100 acres, they can. If they want to do 1,000 acres, fine, you know. I'll help them. You know, and they've got to still meet all the environmental issues and all of the other issues that go with that. But this one issue says we're not really open for business. We kind of are if you play by our rules, and we'll squeeze it down to a small size so you immediately have to go into some kind of an exception to do anything else. And that's just really is a chilling effect on China coming here and buying up half of Oregon for solar. And we don't want to do that.
We don't. And the other part of that, if I can just add to that, both Representative Witt and Thompson's comments, are it isn't just a matter of opening for business and recruiting and hoping. This bill is generated because we have people saying, we want to do this.
Yes.
We're ready to do this. And that's the part that concerns me. That's the part that I hated about Sine Die, was that all of us, doesn't matter your party, I believe are united, jobs, 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 and this one left jobs on the table,
yep.
Let alone what jobs, you know, are in the future. So that's enough of that, of my speech on that.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I may join in there to explain a little bit of my reluctance to comment on the culmination of this task force. I attempted to get to the meeting. I had an emergency I had to deal with in my mouth, and the dentist ruled. So I missed the meeting, the final meeting, and relied on, I showed up right about the time they broke up. So just with that said, I would have been right with Representative Thompson and Witt on that issue. And my comments on that, to that particular piece is exactly what they've said. Plus, we have a manufacturer in the state who, you know, is probably more tooled up than somebody who's not here yet, to ready to go on this, and absolutely right with I call my district the Upper Left Coast. Representative Benst is the Upper East Coast of the state, and we kind of have a symbiotic relationship here. I try to take care of him. I don't purport to know what it's like to live over there. I've been over there. I just know it's drier and sunnier, and I know it's way sunnier, but everybody who knows me knows I'm working hard on ocean energy issues, and I know that this is something that could help us meet quickly our renewable portfolio standard requirements, or at least help get us partway there. And we're working hard to do that, and I look at a country like Scotland, which I've been expounding for months, saying, oh, they're at 80% for their RPS. They're at 100% now. Renewable. They're 100% renewable is their goal, and they're meeting it. And I have to channel a little bit of Mike Schaffler, Representative Schaffler here, and say if we could get to a point where we could consider hydro renewable, I think we'd be there. But I'm going to stop because that's not in my comments here. So on to our second topic, the wildlife standard. And this was an area where we did find some agreement with the work group. The current standard in LCDC's administrative rules includes a requirement that species of concern be addressed, and this category caused a great deal of concern, and it was mostly about timing and the federal tax credits, etc. I was lucky to hear some of that conversation, and Art's going to expound on that in a minute. And it actually says here, after great work by Art Martin from Department of Fish and Wildlife, the group was able to agree on some changes to the administrative rule that would remove the species of concern language, and he's here to talk about the rationale for these changes.
Chairs, committee members, for the record, my name is Art Martin, and I am the Energy and Natural Resource Damage Assessment Coordinator within Wildlife Division for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. So I'm fairly new to this, the energy arena, just started this position in July of 2012. So I, after listening to the discussion of the work group regarding essentially unnecessary ambiguity around the wildlife standard, seemed to be the largest rub, I went back and I consulted with my district wildlife bios, particularly the ones, some of which were out in Representative Bence's part of the state, but mostly Southeast Oregon, to talk with the ones who'd actually participated in the siting of solar in Oregon, and essentially to find out how the process went, educate myself, and talk about which species were actually of concern in a solar siting and which species really hadn't been of concern in for the solar siting that we do have in Oregon. And then secondarily, I went back and did a little research to look at just what did species of concern mean to the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife as well as the state in terms of our OARs and regulations, and then also the special status species list, which are referred to in the wildlife standard as well. And essentially the conclusion that I came to was that all the species that were of concern with the solar siting that has occurred in Oregon are already listed on the sensitive species, or excuse me, the special status species list. This concept of species of concern really has no definitive meaning with an ODFNW's regulations or OARs. And so my proposal, the straw man, was essentially let's remove any reference to species of concern, essentially moving us in the direction of better transparency and hopefully then hastening the timelines for the siting of solar relative to fish and wildlife resources or natural resources, which I believe the committee unanimously agreed with. And essentially, that is the straw man that was proposed for the wildlife standard changes. And I would take any questions of the committee.
Questions?
Representative, I'll just say that's great news. That's really great news.
Representative Bence.
Thank you, and I appreciate your efforts. The question I guess I would ask, you said hopefully that doesn't mean it's going to speed things up. So in your opinion, what do we need to do to get rid of that word, hopefully, and actually make it happen? Because what I see happening is we change this language, but it doesn't remove the foundation for objections to activities on these lands. So the question is, what do we need to do so that we make it much more probable that something will actually happen, as opposed to the maybes and the... Because, as Representative Thompson points out, we're not going to get those investment dollars here if they... folks show up and have to wait 5 years for these, the word hopefully, to be worked out.
Chair Gillum, Representative Bence, yes, I believe there's two options here, a short-term and a long-term option. The short-term option, of course, includes clarification about the species that may be of concern, which this, these changes to the wildlife standard will do, in addition to better communication, earlier communication between developers and district wildlife biologists. I know my people reach out and are open to early and often communication with the developers, try to help them steer them in the right way and let them know as early as possible if there are species or habitats in areas they're interested in. I think the long-term solution is really some type of a mapping exercise that identifies where these species actually are on the landscape, and I do believe that's embedded in the governor's 10-year draft energy plan. If we could map our natural resources and the occurrence of these species and habitats, we could present that information directly to developers early on, possibly identifying areas where there are no natural, no fish and wildlife resources of concern, and helping them to manage the risk of where to site.
Please, Representative Bence.
Here's the situation, and I'm just going to use the sage grouse as an example. The sage grouse, as a species, takes up millions of acres, although there's just a few of them. And so the net result is that if we do a mapping exercise, there's going to be one sage grouse or one pygmy rabbit or one ground squirrel. There's going to be something out there. So at some point, there has to be a choice. The solution to that choice is going to be where our focus should be, because as long as there's a foundation to challenge the decision, things just won't happen. And so I think we almost have to assume that that mapping would reflect some of the existence of those species. We have to assume it. Now what do we do? Because all that happens with all these other things is you delay, and you don't get rid of the obstacles to moving forward. So again, I don't want to overlook the value of the sage grouse or the other species. On the other hand, we have that 19 million acres, and that's not all of eastern Oregon. That's just a portion of it. And we have to move past this minutia to a broader view of things. So I guess I'm asking, do you think that this mapping would actually result in the removal of obstacles or merely the more the fine-tuning of them?
Chair Gillum, Representative Bence, I believe that this isn't about essentially necessarily removing obstacles. I think that's certainly the goal here. But I think it just comes down to equity between evaluating fish and wildlife resources, natural resources, and the ability to site solar or any energy in Oregon. And so, again, this isn't an either-or proposition. This is essentially just risk assessment as to where are the locations where it's easiest and quickest to site and where are the locations where risk might be greater.
Please. I appreciate that. There's a hope that we'll find that there's just nothing there. And that's what you're saying. If there's just nothing there, then we can move forward. But I think we'll find there's something out there. And then we're going to be still in the same boat. But maybe we can address what we do when we find something in a way that actually moves us forward. And the reason I say this again, and I want to bring it back to a discussion of, I'm going to use irrigation pivots, because 300 acres under one pivot is very normal. One pivot. We don't do any of this analysis for that pivot. And that's on ground that actually is flat and probably worth something. Where we're going to put these other things is going to be much less valuable. Anyway, I look forward to working with you on it.
Representative Thompson.
You know, the other issue I think we need to get involved with on this, on the wildlife issue, is our exclusionary attitude. There's an assumption that if we do anything on property in eastern Oregon, as an example, that's going to disrupt some pristine natural environment and make a sage grouse angry. In fact, most of that land has been grazed for the last 150 years. It's not pristine natural habitat to start with. And secondly, I can't find any studies that tell me that if you put in a 2,500-acre solar array and cyclone fence it, which you would likely do for security reasons, you won't get the sage grouse moving into that territory because of the exclusion of coyotes, and they won't thrive in the shade of solar panels. Animals are incredibly adaptive, and our attitude that if we go out there and just saw off one sagebrush bush, it's going to bring the entire environment to its knees is just plain naive. That's not how it works, and we have numerous examples of wildlife adapting and thriving to changing conditions, and I think we have to take a close look at that. I'm not so concerned about your one sage grouse per 100,000 acres as I am, what's the possibility if we did something like this, we'd actually get five sage grouse per 100,000 acres. But the assumption is any disruption whatsoever is going to eliminate the sage grouse. And I argue that no, that's not. It's not reasonable. How about a 2,500-acre fenced exclusion to test the theory? Be a good thing for Fish and Wildlife to do.
Welcome,
okay,
Kyle.
With that, I'm going to exercise my position in the middle here and comment on that, because this is reminding me of all the efforts that have been put into things on the very west side of our state, having to do with oceans, from marine reserves to ocean energy siting, et cetera, and the process they've gone through, long and lengthy, doing it what we call the Oregon way, by inviting all stakeholders to the table. This group was a small composite of that. And we do have in the audience some members of the group, and I wouldn't, at the risk of leaving anybody out that I didn't, because I can't see behind me, we do have three I know of, and another one, John Audley, David Brown, Steve McCoy, and one of the developers. And so I would like to invite them up to the table to answer any questions you have and comment on this, how we get there without taking an inordinate amount of time to do it and letting the clock run out for various reasons. But Art has talked about some of the things that he's doing, and Todd's talking about the policy that they make. We can do this, and I think that Representative Bentz, we are only coming into the next session, and I am perpetually optimistic in this building. I don't think that anything's dead until after sine die. So there is hope. We do have the placeholder. I think we continue going on. I think everybody on the group, from what I heard at that last meeting, was willing to continue, and I don't think it should take more than one more meeting and just get everybody in a room and drill something out. So with that, I would like to invite the members of the group up here to answer any questions you might have and give any comments they might have from their perspective.
I think that's a great idea, Representative. I probably would hold us just 10 more minutes on this subject, but I think it's a great idea. We're going to have to temporarily adjourn to go out to the Capitol steps for the unveiling of the Nike swoosh on the Capitol man on the Pioneer. So we don't want to miss that. Please come up. I worked on that this morning.
See, I needed you for them.
Now, we can do this as
a
Q&A.
You can bring the other chair up if you want.
But if you'd like to make a brief comment first, introduce for the record, and we'll go from there.
Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, my name is David Brown. I've had the pleasure of being before this committee several times in the last few years talking about solar development. I'd like to make a couple of general comments first to bring the committee up to date on some, I think, very exciting developments. First, our two largest solar projects in Oregon have been completed this summer. They're producing energy, not so much today, but they were very successful projects, well received by the community, and there's just been a lot of enthusiasm around the state for those projects, and there are dozens, if not 100 people, who should be thanked for their efforts in getting those projects completed. The second thing I want to tell you is that there has been a very exciting development in solar energy over the last 18, maybe 24 months, and especially even in the last 12 months, which is that costs have continued to come down more than anybody expected. A lot of that is driven by the fact that solar panel manufacturers are fighting for their very lives. There's a huge surplus of capacity worldwide in solar panels, and prices of solar panels have dropped dramatically. Panel manufacturers around the world are losing money. It's a cause of some concern, but for people who buy those things, the prices have dropped significantly. More importantly, what we call the balance of system, you know, everything else besides the panel, has also come down significantly, and a lot of that has to do with experience. I think I've mentioned this to you before, but for our first project, we budgeted $1 million in legal, accounting, and engineering fees, and we spent it all. And for the next project, that number is more like $150,000. So that's one. Contingencies. We had big contingency budgets that we didn't need in our first project. So for the next project, we'll have much smaller. The experience is really helping. So there's reason to pursue your objective here of getting solar projects sited more easily, because costs have come down significantly. And then second, because of the additional credibility that we have by having done some projects, it's easier to get better information. It's easier for me to get better information about costs. I share that with you. We believe that if you go from a 2-megawatt project, which is the size of the Black Cap project outside of Lakeview, to a 10-megawatt project, which Oregon has not yet built, costs are going to be 10% less due to economies of scale. If you go from a 10-megawatt project to a 50-megawatt project, you're going to save another 10% because economies of scale. And those numbers are significant. So to achieve a 20% reduction in the cost of energy when solar is trying to compete with fossil fuels is a very significant number. So OSEA has a report coming out called Visor that will get into all this in more detail. Very exciting. So I wanted to start with those comments. As to the work group, I was very excited about the progress you made on wildlife. I have nothing but compliments for the work of the state administrators and employees who helped with that, and I thought that the array of people we had in the room on those issues was very effective. The issue that's remaining is what I would call agricultural land impact. It's not so much the wildlife issue, because I think we have that pretty well understood in a framework. And I think it is very helpful to talk about the state in its different constructs. It's not quite as simple as Eastern Oregon, Willamette Valley, because there's more to the state than just those two regions. But those are the two that present the issue in the sharpest focus. So, and I'll point out that where we are right now is that if I'm bringing a data center to Oregon and I want to power it with solar power, I can get the data center open way faster than I can get approval to put up solar panels. Way faster. Yes. Thank you.
Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, I am Steve McCoy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. One thing I'd like to point out is the discussion, the starting point for the discussions, and the discussions as they went the entire time were about lifting limitations, not about placing limitations. One thing that we've seen throughout the state is quite a bit of wind generation being sited, and wind's fantastic. You can still ranch under wind turbines. You can still farm under wind turbines. Out in the eastern part of the state that we're talking about is where three of the top five commodities that are grown in the state are produced. Cattle is number one. Milk is number two. And hay, which there's some production out there, as well as certainly lots of consumption of it, is number five in the state. It's not an area that's bereft of agriculture. Ranching is a large driver of the economy out there. One thing that we heard from the committee, from the members of the, not committee, of the work group, was that there's really one project that this would have affected right now, and that is one that is being brought by the federal government, actually. So they will be going through a NEPA process anyway. So again, what we're talking about here is simply the trigger for going to the Energy Facility Siting Council, not for what can be done or what the largest project that can be done is. It's simply whether it's done at the county level or done at FSEC. So it's not about stopping developments. It's merely about what size of development does it start making sense to have more eyes on it, more people looking at it, and a longer timeline to be able to actually look at it, because when things are done at the county level, there is a very short timeline that things must be done in. Otherwise, they must issue the permit. We did make progress. I felt like we were going to get somewhere, and ultimately we did not. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Audley, Deputy Director of the Renewable Northwest Project. Thank you for inviting me to visit with you today. Just one quick point, because I'm anxious to hear your questions and comments. Thanks, Beth, for herding the cats. You did a great job. We did make progress. And I wanted to underscore that, guided or prodded by you, we have made progress over the past couple of years. We've expanded the exception footprint on marginal agricultural land. We are, in some sense, moving in response to opportunities presented us by companies like David's and needs expressed by entities like the Oregon Army National Guard. But there will be other opportunities or pressure points, if you will. I think new large load centers, that's a fancy way of saying data centers, are interested in sourcing renewable energy as close to them as they possibly can. For many of these companies, green energy is part of their business image. They want it. That's one reason they come here, because we do have so much hydro as a foundation, and it is a renewable energy. So I look forward to continued guidance prodding from you all, because we can figure this out, although I do think it'll take more than one meeting. Thank you.
Before we have questions, we have two other guests I'd like to have, be able to say a few words. If you just vacate two chairs, John and, I'm sorry.
Al.
Yeah. Come up, identify, and we'd be happy for your comments. We need to keep moving, but we're very glad that you have joined us as well.
Representative Gilliam, members of the committee, thanks a lot for the opportunity. My name is Alan Hickenbottom. I am with, I guess, several things that are around this. I manage the division at Christensen Electric in Portland that does renewables, energy efficiency, and new technology. It was our IBEW guys that were on site at the Outback project, which we'd love to give Representative Benson, anybody else who would like to see it. I'm sure Mr. Brown would enjoy that as well, to have a tour of Oregon's newest, largest solar array. I also think I occupy a somewhat unique position that I'm also on the board of the Oregon Natural Desert Association. And I would like to say to Representative Benz, would love to have a further discussion. I think we do have areas of commonality. I don't want to speak for the organization, but myself, that the kinds of developments that we're talking about here in the lower, sorry, I don't know my land use terminology, but like lands like Christmas Valley, that we are also, both from my developer hat and my other hat, looking for ways to make those work. So we were very supportive of that type of development, certainly from my business side, but I think also from some of the other things that I'm associated with. So we look forward to finding solutions. I'm born and raised Oregonian. I'm very comfortable on both those worlds. We need to figure out how to do this, and I think we can. I would agree with the other comments. I think we're fairly close on the FSEC policy, and I would just point out in closing, current solar technology for PV is about, would be a, roughly an FSEC criteria level at a section, a square mile, 640 acres. So I don't want to place that position out there, but I would just point as a point out as a point of data that that's an interesting place to think about from how people think about land, but also under current law, that amount of acreage does fit for current solar technology and the FSEC criteria, so that might be something to think about. But other than that, the work group I thought was great. I really appreciated your sponsorship. Beth was great. It was a very cooperative process, so thanks a lot.
Thank you for those comments. John.
Good morning, Chair Gilliam, members of the committee. John Molis, I'm the Executive Secretary of the Oregon State Building Trades Council. And the IBEW are affiliates of the council in the Portland area. Thanks to Intel, they're probably at full employment. In the outlying areas of the state where these projects would likely be sited, they're probably unemployed anywhere from 20 to 30%. So these folks are chomping at the bit to go back to work. I appreciate Alan's comments, and at the last task force meeting, there was extensive discussion and comments from both of these gentlemen as far as how do you make these things pencil. And I appreciate the earlier comments from all the committee members. We say Oregon's open for business. We say solar is one of our leading indicators. We want to support our local solar manufacturers. We want to put our people to work. I hope this committee can meet, and I hope all of you can keep the pressure on all of us to find a reasonable compromise so we can make these things pencil, support this industry, which deserves our support, and put people back to work. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Representative Boone, I am just so upset. I am getting hopeful again.
I knew it would rub off.
Any comments or questions?
And Mr. Chair, if I may, I would like to also thank Co-Vice Chair Boone for her leadership and Beth Petrino for, again, herding the cats. Nice job. Thank you.
Beth did a great job.
Oh, if I might, in closing, just so when we in the solar industry came together this year, it was, for us, it was a lot about what we called hitting singles. we feel are so close. David's comments on solar pricing, the energy markets, we have considered the Betsy is gone, and that's fine. I would say we don't need it anymore, but we're very close to making these pencils with adjustments. Species of concern, done, FSEC, we're getting there. You may well see another bill this term regarding adjustments to energy or FTE requirements, full-time equivalent requirements within enterprise zones that would allow flexibilities for the counties in granting those. That would be just another little help for these, because I do believe we're close. So these individual projects that we're working on together really will make a difference.
Thank you for that. Questions or comments? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hope springs eternal, thank goodness. And I would just say that while all this discussion has been going on over the last couple of years, we've grown ever closer to the ending of the federal tax credit. And so with all the talk, and nothing happening, we're losing out on a third of that subsidy. My last remark, again, goes to scale, and it's that two Willamette Valleys would fit in Malheur County. Two Willamette Valleys would fit in Harney County. One would fit in Grant County. 1.5 would fit in Lake County. That's Willamette Valleys. And yet, we still are talking about 100 acres. What is that? It's what we need is a ratio that we apply instantly when we move past Bend and start the five-hour drive to Ontario. And that ratio might be 10 to 1, just right off the top, just instantly. So we get back into some sort of foundation based on proper scale. But people in Onda or 1,000 Friends or any other group takes a Willamette Valley mindset into Eastern Oregon. And sometimes you got to somehow get bigger. And I work with Onda all the time, work with 1,000 Friends. Bless your hearts. Life goes on, time passes, tax credits expire, nothing happens. So, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I share your hope. I think it's closer to a wish, but okay. I'll work with you. Try to get something done.
Thank you for that comment, Representative Boone.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I have worked long and hard. I think he's come a long way. But Representative Benz is getting close, just like the rest. So with that said, I really like your idea of this committee meeting over there. Maybe not the whole legislature, just thinking of the drive, and we'd all have to put studs on our cars. But maybe if we met at some point, one meeting, you know, whether it's during session or interim or whatever, but I think I remember hearing stories of legislative exchanges before from people who live in the Willamette Valley and west of the mountains and those on the east side, and having their experience over a weekend staying at a ranch or farm and coming back with eyes wide open. So I think it's always a good thing to know your neighbors more. I've actually flown over Ontario, but I don't think I've actually been there. I'm willing to go.
I am too. I will have a lot more time in the next session.
Yeah, you will. Okay.
Other comments?
Please, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was very encouraged by Alan's comments that we're on the cusp of no longer needing Betsy. And I'm encouraged because I see a lot of incentives that that we put forward to help initial development of industries never seem to disappear. Even though some of them have sunsets, they still continue. And I think that in many, many instances, our good efforts and intentions at helping new industries get off the ground actually end up, when they never do sunset, interrupting markets. And I see that having happened in the solar industry and a number of other industries. And again, I think being able to build to scale, along with a number of other efforts, would make it cost efficient for a number of these industries to be able to operate on their own, absent the need for a lot of subsidies, which in the long run inhibit the development of many of these industries. So, Alan, thank you for your comments, and I appreciate very much not only your advocacy for the development of the industry, but also making sure that that is done in a sustainable manner in terms of your environmental pursuits. Thank you for your service.
Thank you, Representative Witt.
Long but worthwhile presentation. So thank you all for adding to it. We appreciate it.
Thank you for your time.
And I would love to take Representative Boone's suggestion about moving over and Ontario Burns, you name it.
We'll take him to the site.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Let's stay tuned on that.
We'll do it. Okay.
Colleagues, thank you for your patience on that item, but I think we can all agree how important it is, and I appreciate the discussion very much. I want to just ask our new energy director to come forward. I'd like to. She's been very patient, and I want to make sure that everybody on the committee has a chance just to say hello. This is our new energy director, Lisa Schwartz, and I've enjoyed my first meeting with her. She's got a huge job in front of her and an important agency, and we were pleased that you would come and join us today. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's been my pleasure to meet with many of you already this week, and I very much look forward to working with you as we prepare for the 2013 legislative session, and I especially appreciate the opportunity to allow me to introduce myself again to you this morning. I offer myself and my staff to you, our technical and policy expertise.
And it's important that you self introduce for the record. Sorry.
For the record, this is Lisa Schwartz, the new director of the Oregon Department of Energy.
Thank you.
And I actually do know better because I am returning to state service where I was for 22 years. It's a pleasure to be back. Thank you for the reminder. I am the spanking new director of the Oregon Department of Energy. I began here only last Monday, and I'm working hard to shore up our expertise and our customer service and be of service to you all. My job really today is simply to introduce to you Link Philippi, who is the president of Rough and Ready Lumber Company, as well as my staffer, Matt Krumenauer. They have served as co-chairs of the Forest Biomass Working Group. And they're here to talk to you today about their work for that group. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Before you leave, do you need any clarification on Representative Bence's position on the 100-acre trigger?
We'll get back to you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, Lord.
Thank you. So if those guests would come forward, we'll move on to that. Identify for the record and welcome.
Thank you. Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, my name is Matt Krumenauer. I'm a senior policy analyst at the Oregon Department of Energy. I'm joined here today with Mr. Philippi with Rough and Ready Lumber Company. I have the honor of serving with him as co-chair of the state's Forest Biomass Work Group. I'm going to give you a brief overview of the Forest Biomass Work Group. I think that this is the first time that we've ever had the chance to present to your committee, so I want to thank you for that. And I'll provide a brief overview of the new forest biomass strategy that the group has released, and then I'll turn it over to Mr. Philippi to give his take on why this is important for the industry and why it's important for Oregon. And I'll start really by saying that the economic well-being of many of our rural communities is inseparable from the health and management of our forests. These forests provide employment, they protect our watersheds, they provide valuable habitat. One thing I enjoy is their unparalleled recreational opportunities, and they also are a driver for our economy. And we have an opportunity to improve the health of our forests create economic opportunity using those resources, and serve as a driver of local renewable energy sources. And I think I enjoy working on this because biomass is really unique among renewable energy sectors in that it's the only source that can provide for all of our energy uses, not only electricity, but also heat and transportation fuels. I'm very honored to be able to work on it on behalf of the state. The Forest Biomass Work Group was formed back in 2006. It serves as a forum for recommending policies, for identifying barriers, and advancing the utilization of biomass in the state. It's a group of a broad range of stakeholders, including industry, nonprofits, conservation organizations, and supported by federal and state agency staff. We have over 40 organizations that actively participate in it. I've got a mailing list that's massive. And we're really lucky to have the support of many of the key industry groups as well as the conservation community throughout the development of our strategy. So if you look back, the group in 2007 released a report with a series of recommendations to the then Renewable Energy Working Group, and many of those recommendations were incorporated into the legislation that advanced during that session, and we've come a long way. We've made some progress to date, but I don't believe that the group believes we've realized the potential for biomass in Oregon. Things have changed since 2006-2007 when the group first released its recommendations. We've seen changes to our economy. We've seen changes to the policies and the incentives that have been offered for this industry. And we felt that we needed to provide a new path forward. And so we developed a process where we held meetings around the state. We had over 100 different organizations and individuals participate in identifying what the current barriers are and what we needed to do to move this industry forward. And on November 1 of this year, we, by consensus, adopted a new forest biomass strategy for the state. The strategy really is focused on market development. The number one barrier that we identified facing this industry was the lack of markets for biomass. So the strategy focuses on four market development initiatives and then a series of enabling recommendations. Those market development initiatives are to start with distributed generation, which Link is going to talk about. Thermal energy, such as the good progress we've seen in converting some of our existing schools, hospitals, and other public buildings to biomass thermal systems. Also looking at emerging markets, such as aviation fuels, pyrolysis, torrefaction, and other advanced conversion technologies. And then finally, and importantly, enhancing and expanding existing markets, and especially export opportunities for existing markets. One of the things that we've built into the strategy is the realization that we do not want to disrupt existing markets for fiber, pulp and paper, particle board, strand board, things like that. And we also want to allow the market to use biomass for its highest value. So there's strong businesses in Oregon that are making animal bedding out of biomass, and we want to be able to allow them the opportunity to expand, and that's really a strong part of our strategy as well. And then to help support those market development initiatives, we need to have a strong outreach and education component so we can educate decision makers, we can educate the public and the industry about what the opportunities are, why it's important for Oregon. We also need to make sure that we're ensuring sustainability and that as we grow this industry, we're growing it in a way that can continue the strong protections we have for our natural resources and enhance and contribute to the goals that the state has set for greenhouse gas reductions, our integrated water resources strategy, and our forest management goals. We also need to integrate closely with broader federal forest policy. So we've had a real strong working relationship with the various state and federal agencies to help advance forest restoration on our east side dry forests, as well as the management of our west side forests, and providing strong opportunities for private landowners to add more value to their land. And then finally, as we begin to look at incentives, we believe that the state should target the existing incentives and our business development programs towards these market development goals and helping to support the existing businesses we have and use those incentives and tools that we have in place to help develop new markets for biomass. So I'm going to turn it over to Link to give his perspective as a business owner.
Thank you for being here. Can I ask you first, did you come today from Cave Junction?
No, I was already up in Portland. I had a separate meeting up there, so I'm,
right. I thought I'm you had a long
but
time
I do make that drive quite often.
All right, okay. Welcome. If you self-identify, we're eager to
relatively remote. Mr. Chairman and committee members, thanks for having us here. My name is Link Philippi. I co-chair the Forest Biomass Work Group with Matt, and the group has put together a thoughtful strategy to help support a healthy biomass industry in the state of Oregon. I'm also, as mentioned, I'm president of Rough and Ready Lumber Company. We're a small family-owned business located in Cave Junction in the Illinois Valley, southwestern part of the state. And I'm pleased to say that this is our 90th year in business. We were founded in 1922, and we're still around. We operate two sawmills and a biomass cogeneration plant that we built in 2006. And we employ 85 people and own and manage timberlands in Josephine, Jackson, and Southern Douglas counties. We cut ponderosa pine, sugar pine, and Douglas fir. And our focus is on dry products, so we operate a wood-fired boiler and dry kilns to dry our product. I want to describe, just kind of give you a general overview of what Matt described of the biomass and bioenergy. They're both very important parts of the forest products industry and can complement existing operations, reduce costs, and add new revenue streams. Very promising technology with some difficulties ahead. I also want to talk about the specifics of my company's decision to invest in biomass and talk about the biomass industry on a larger statewide level. Then I want to discuss some of the challenges we face in this industry, both from the biomass cost side and from the utility pricing side. My comments, as Matt said, are primarily focused on the distributed generation initiative identified in the Forest Biomass Work Group strategy. I know quite a bit about this industry since my business invested in it pretty significantly in 2006 with what seemed to be a promising future in helping our manufacturing facility dry more lumber and produce a solid revenue stream from power generation. The current situation is far from what we expected when we invested. We're facing three significant hurdles in our industry. Number one, the high capital costs of constructing biomass energy plants, the high capital and operating costs of removing biomass from the woods, and the low prices for renewable power received from the utilities. There's a strong synergy between forest products facilities and the biomass industry where mill residuals along with biomass can be burned to make steam. Biomass utilization and energy production isn't something new. We've been doing it for years. The forest products industry has been utilizing wood boilers to make steam to dry wood products for many years. And many companies have been generating power in addition to running boilers. We've been the leader in combined heat technology, where otherwise known as cogeneration, where the steam has two beneficial uses. We use steam to spin a turbine, create electricity, and we use the heat from that steam to dry lumber or other wood products. It's been called the triple win by many in the state. We efficiently produce steam, produce clean, renewable power, and offset our fossil fuel uses. We utilize mill waste residuals and create healthy forests from thinning overdense stands and reducing fuel loads, which also helps reduce the cost of fighting fires. Supporting healthy businesses and rural communities by creating jobs and keeping energy dollars in local economies, important. Briefly, I want to discuss our project. While we discussed the three benefits from this type of biomass project, our primary reason was from our business perspective. We needed more kilns, more steam to dry more lumber. We went through several, we looked at it for years to invest in the technology to build a bigger boiler, but the cost of a boiler the costs exceeded the paybacks. The long high costs, long paybacks wasn't an investment that we were willing to undertake. But back in the mid 2005, 2006, there were incentives that were lining up for plants of our size and incentives throughout the state to help us defray those costs and consider power production in addition to creating steam boilers, or upsizing our boilers. It kind of coincided, our thought process with building a boiler plant was in line with when we had the Biscuit Fire in Southern Oregon. A tremendous fire. The discussion was about fuel loads and about forest health and what we're going to do about it. And incentives were created back then to make things happen. So we started looking at the incentives in the form of loans, tax credits, and grants. And we came up with a project that basically came together in 2006 that allowed us to build a $6 million cogeneration facility at our plant. Couldn't have happened without grants, without tax credits. I wouldn't be here today if those programs weren't in place. The Betsy is significantly very important in our decision to build the plant. We did receive several federal grants. We also received tax credits from the state. There were all sorts of incentives out there. They were critical for our decision to construct the project. But I want to say we can't think of biomass in a vacuum. We, without a longer-term dependable and economic log supply, biomass will not be a success in Oregon. We, like many other combined heat and power producers, are primary wood manufacturers. And without affordable logs and affordable fuel, my business won't survive, and investments in cogeneration will be wasted. Within 30 miles of our facility lies over 2 million acres of mostly public forest that is ground zero in need of fuel treatment and thinning. To handle all the biomass available, all our existing biomass cogen plants need to be utilized to their full potential, and more plants will be needed beyond that. Our plant can utilize biomass coming off about 3,000 acres a year. It will just scratch the surface of the biomass treatments, of the fuel treatments needed. Making these plants economically viable is important because there are many large and small scattered wood products manufacturers throughout, located throughout Oregon in areas around forests in need of fuel and health treatments. Again, I can't emphasize enough that biomass is not a standalone industry. In order for success, the forest products industry and the forest land managers need a comprehensive approach to forestry in order for the economics to work. The cost of removing biomass almost always exceeds the value of the end uses, usually revenues from power generation. Therefore, incentives and appropriate power prices are necessary for economic success. Without changes, the prognosis for the biomass industry in Oregon is not good. The now-defunct Betsy was the single most important consideration in Rough and Ready's decision to build our plant. Without the Betsy or similar incentives to help cover capital costs, construction of our new facilities will be problematic. Notwithstanding those challenges, the state's first priority and focus of the Forest Biomass Work Group strategy should be to ensure the survival and profitable operation of its existing biomass generation base. There are currently 15 biomass power plants in Oregon with a combined nameplate capacity of nearly 250 megawatts. Most stand ready with little or no additional capital investment to begin generating and selling clean, baseload, renewable power to the grid. Yet because of challenges, including the need for predictable and economic fuel supplies, low avoided costs for biomass power, and unfair treatment under the RPS, Renewable Power Portfolio Standards, for many of these plants, only a small fraction of that capacity is being used. One critical incentive that is still in place is the $10 per bone-dry ton biomass collector's tax credit, which helps make fuel supplies more affordable, although the halving of the tax credit has reduced its impact. Equally important, however, is the need for a certain and dependable pricing structure for generated power paid by the utilities. Avoided cost, the rate qualified facilities, QFs, or private generators like Rough and Ready, get paid for their power by the utilities. is tied to the forecasted prices of natural gas. As everyone knows, natural gas prices are at a very low level today and are expected to remain that way for years to come. This power rate structure is extremely problematic for the biomass industry. Unless this changes, biomass will not be successful in Oregon. The rates are not created by comparing our biomass resource against the correct utility resource. Avoided cost prices should reflect the cost to a utility needing to buy the next marginal megawatt hour of that resource. The utilities get rates through the PUC process covering their investments in renewables, but QFs are treated entirely different. We need a renewable avoided cost rate that is calculated correctly. Also, the PUC needs direction from the legislature to tie avoided cost rates directly and solely to the resource being used. Those rates should not be tied to the disposition of QF RECs, renewable energy credits. When my company made the decision in 2006 to invest in renewable energy, rates paid to us were higher than our industrial rates paid to the utility by about $10 a megawatt hour. Since then, our industrial rates at Rough and Ready have increased by over 46%. Our renewable rates for sold power have increased by only 3% per year. Today's avoided cost rates in 2013 for new biomass plants coming online are set at around $34 a megawatt from Pacific Core. That doesn't cover half the cost of producing biomass energy, where the marginal costs for Rough and Ready are between $75 and $85 a megawatt. The reality today is that the future of biomass in Oregon is bleak, and the need to implement the Forest Biomass Working Group strategy all the more important. The need for the industry is strong when it comes down to rural jobs, forest health, and renewable energy. We know the economics don't work due to high capital costs and low energy prices. The RPS in Oregon was created by the state legislature to promote renewable energy projects alongside our existing facilities. I'm concerned today that our existing biomass infrastructure is at risk if the legislature doesn't step up. For example, it would be very helpful to the biomass industry to establish that a certain percentage of RECs in the RPS need to come from biomass. If the struggling biomass industry is to survive and grow in Oregon, the legislature needs to take corrective actions as outlined in the Forest Biomass Work Group strategy. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
You bet.
We may lose some members here at 10, so quickly, comments or questions for you to get.
I have two. Link. I couldn't believe it. Two links sitting together in the room. Yeah. Unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
You mentioned public lands, and I'm wondering, is it both state and federal lands? Because I'm wondering, do you buy, and several questions maybe, do you buy the biomass from a logging show, and do you buy them from the state?
There's not a lot of state land down where we're located. A lot of Josephine County's 80%, Josephine County's 70% owned by the federal government. In our valley, it's 80%. We do buy biomass from the Forest Service and BLM and other private suppliers. Very little state lands are involved.
Do you know if other biomass producers buy from the state?
I'm sure they do.
Okay. And I had one other question. The RPS, you said the treatment was unfair. Is that because of that kind of arbitrary date? So that cogen plants built before 1994, whatever that date is, 95, don't count in the RPS, and those afterwards do? I'm just curious if that.
That's one level of concern that the pre-95 existing plants, they need to be treated equally as the.
Do you know how many there are?
Let's see. Pre-95.
Maybe 10 or a dozen.
Yeah, there's a dozen of them probably.
Out of the, would you say 15?
There's quite a large capacity in those pre-existing, those earlier plants. Yeah.
Thanks.
Representative Krieger, Vice Chair Krieger.
I need to come by and visit because your parking lot on the west side is in my district. Your mill isn't.
Is it right?
But I'm familiar with it. I just did a little forestry operation where I just got done burning biomass.
Piles,
big as this room, high as they can stack it, but there's no way to transport it efficiently, like you say, to anywhere. So I believe,
was it Representative Thompson? Didn't you have a bill
for him? But it was an incentive bill to help cover the transportation costs.
Let me just step out.
Because where you're located, Dan, like you say, you've got a certain amount of area that you can efficiently utilize it from.
Right.
Where I am, there's nothing. You know, we had to burn. I could have harvested that in some way and got the heat into my house. I've had heat in my house for 200 years, but it just all went up in the air.
Right.
But I would like to come by sometime, and I'll get a hold of you.
You're welcome anytime. It's we're always there.
Yeah.
Yep.
Representative Thompson, then Representative Witt.
What do we need to make this work? I mean, we need better technology in drum grinders or compaction, or how do we make the transportation piece, the production and transportation piece work? Now, obviously, you're not going to haul it in open trucks of whole limbs and other debris. Yeah. You can get enough packed in there. But is there a weak point we can address, or is this just an evolutionary process?
The problem is the value, the commercial value of the product doesn't pay its way out of the woods. And the transportation tax credit, originally at $10 a green ton, I figure probably allowed that biomass to travel. It picked up the cost of transporting that biomass about 40 miles max. Cutting it in half eliminated that working circle, cut it in half. So basically you cut quite a few more acres off the... Yeah. You know, off the map. But $10 a dry ton covers about 15 to 20 miles of transportation costs, and that's doesn't quite cut it. The original tax credit made it somewhat tolerable, but certainly not a moneymaker. A lot of biomass contractors, you know, tooled up back in 06 and 05 and 06 to you know, foreseeing the need for collection and investing in equipment. A lot of people spent a lot of money buying a lot of equipment. And they have since gone away. The whole industry has contracted just because the pricing structure, the economics, don't work. Mm-hmm. Unless there's some form of a subsidy that you know, there's a benefit from biomass. There's a cost issue on how it just doesn't pay out of the woods. So it's a real dilemma.
Representative Witt,
thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for. Trying to develop an industry and provide some jobs in areas where they're hard to come by for folks. I know you've talked about the need for incentives for transportation to haul the stuff out and make it cost feasible. I'm wondering, are there other supply or demand issues here that help develop this industry? Do we have enough resource? Are we at a point where we could develop, I guess what I loosely refer to as supply sheds of biomass, so that we don't have 10 different competitors trying to access the same volume of biomass, and it becomes unprofitable for any one individual because different folks are competing for it? Is it a matter of being able to develop an adequate infrastructure to utilize? I mean, what do you see?
We have a problem. There's the biomass, the forest acreage in need of treatment is significant. It's millions of acres in the state of Oregon. The current infrastructure, it's bigger, it's developed, it's a good working infrastructure. It certainly isn't adequate to handle. If biomass becomes, you know, gets revved up and gets going, there isn't enough capacity to handle what's out there in the woods. There certainly isn't the ability of contractors and collectors to deliver those products. There's a problem with the end users. There isn't enough biomass capacity out there built to date. There isn't enough biomass infrastructure on the collector side to collect all that biomass. We have a tremendous need, tremendous force, you know, fire issues that happen to state year after year. There's a problem with capacity to get that, to handle the biomass and to collect it right now. So that's something we need to work on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would also be interested. I know that we all want to make certain that we're limiting carbon output from our energy sources and whatnot. Could you speak a little bit about the sustainability of this fuel source, that it's has a positive impact on the environment? Of course, you've already discussed the employment impacts. What are the economic opportunities as well?
You want to talk about we manage timberlands. We try to replace the fuel loads and the dead and dying component on our timberlands. We remove that and we are replacing that with healthy growing trees that are mm-hmm. sucking up carbon dioxide mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. providing cleaner air. Biomass industry is, depending on which scientist you listen to, but it's a carbon neutral process. What we remove, we're growing. What we remove and burn in our boilers, we're growing out in the woods to offset the carbon. So it's, to me, we've been practicing on our timberlands for years. We're enhancing by growing our stands. So it's, for the environment, it's a positive thing. You don't have the fires. You don't have the slash piles being burned in the woods. It's a lot cleaner process. So, you want to add to that?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Gilliam, Representative Witt. One of the things that we have taken a look at is that biomass collection activities and harvest activities are one covered under Oregon's Forest Practices Act. So they're regulated. They're subject to the same requirements that any logging or harvest activity would be covered. The other thing, one way to look at it is when we're looking at the carbon question and sort of nutrient recovery and those questions, it's helpful to kind of look at what the alternative fate of this material would be. No one is harvesting biomass for the purpose of producing energy. It's really about how do we better utilize these residual products, either a pile of slash, mm-hmm. as Representative Krieger had some experience with lately, or a mill residual, or the result of a forest health treatment. We're doing these activities for some other reason. So that material is either going to be left in the woods to decompose and release methane, which is a potent greenhouse gas, or it's going to be burned in slash piles. So what we're able to do is develop facilities like Rough and Ready that can utilize that material in a controlled environment, get the energy value out of it, and help contribute to his management of forest lands.
Well, I thank you for your answers. I think those are important as we go forward, knowing full well that this is a sustainable energy source. It offers, I think, some very significant opportunities in a lot of portions of our state where opportunities are oftentimes limited. And on this committee, you'll see a number of rural legislators, and we're very eager for these kinds of opportunities. So I would encourage you as you see the need for our assistance to by all means please let us know so that we can take every possible opportunity and advantage of this much needed energy source. Thank you.
Well said. The very patient Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. I'm not sure, Mr. Chair, you're as patient. It looks like you're eager to get to the next subject. So I just wanted, as an urban legislator, to say how supportive I am of this, too. And I had the pleasure of working. My former boss, Steve Greenwood, is in the audience at Oregon Solutions. I was the program manager for the Vernonia Schools and worked a lot with the Department of Energy to get RF funding of $1.1 million. Through the U.S. Department of Energy to develop biomass thermal heating for the Vernonia schools, and using the slash or the residue from local forest owners, private forest owners in the area, in a very symbiotic relationship. So I think the job creation, the energy creation from a renewable source, the forest management, forest health, so that we don't have the burns that release a lot more carbon and use up a lot of state resources, are all really compelling reasons, and you both give a great presentation about the need to do it and what the barriers are. And I'm sure there's a huge tension between how much of our incentives go toward building the business and bringing more biomass, because we have a huge potential and need to do that, mm-hmm. and yet protecting the investments that we've already made. And I wondered if you could you put out a lot of great things in a not a standalone industry that need to be supported, so thank you very much. I just wanted to focus on one of them, the incentive side, the grants and loans and tax credits, and that tension between supporting the investments we've made and wanting to grow the business. And if you could say, from both of you, what the priorities you think should be as we go forward and how to get the biggest bang for the buck out of our state investments going forward.
Go ahead.
There's two different things to look at. To build these plants, I would tell you that the Betsy was probably the single most important thing to make us build our facility. We had a payback originally on the cost of building our plant of 15 years. Mm-hmm. With the Betsy intact, we reduced that payback to 5. Mm-hmm. So we wouldn't have invested in 15, but we did. 5 seems that's kind of on the edge of investment potential, but that's, we made the choice to do it, but that's, we wouldn't have done it without the Betsy. The collector tax credit is a different issue about, you know, affordability of getting fuel out of the woods. That helps a different part of the business, and that's important. Like I said, a 40-mile radius covers 2 million acres. That's more acres than our plant can handle, but that kind of working circle are the distances that we have to go to get biomass to run our plants. When that's cut in half, they're just, the economics just don't work, and it makes the radius is so small around these plants. Either you have to build more plants, mm-hmm. to cover smaller working circles, mm-hmm. or you have to be able to go out further to reach out to get this biomass to bring it into these plants that there aren't a lot of right now.
So going forward, that's the biomass collector tax credit is what you would want to see continued, enhanced?
Well, we like the original $10 on per green ton, mm-hmm. worked well for a lot of worked well for us. I mean, we having the ability to pass that tax credit to the end user, the generator. We took those tax credits. They're transferable. We could sell them. We could, you know, they're marketable. That was an important part of it. A lot of these collectors don't. Some use these tax credits, but a lot of these small, you know, loggers and other operators in the woods, they don't know how to deal with tax credits, and they just transfer them to us as the generator, probably 99% of the time. Mm-hmm. But it's an important part of the puzzle to get. If you want to cover more acres, having that tax credit in place is very important. One thing I just want to say is the benefits of this biomass fuel reduction and treating these forests, the health issues in the forests. The Biscuit Fire in 2002 burned 500,000 acres, and cost, the suppression costs alone on Biscuit was $165 million. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of money. A lot of money is not all state money, but it's a lot of money being spent on firefighting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, an ounce of prevention by, you know, mm-hmm. treating acres, reducing fuel loads, mm-hmm. pays a lot of bills. So, something to remember.
That's a great emphasis on a very important point. Thank you.
Yep. Other comments or questions?
Thank you. Anybody else?
With that, we thank you for your presentation.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
We have one more item, colleagues. And I'd like to ask Steve Greenwood, who was just mentioned, on the Columbia River Umatilla Solutions Task Force. Thank you for your patience. I kind of put you at the end, and you probably are ready to go as well. But we are very happy you're here and grateful for your presentation.
Great. Thank you, Representative Gillum and members of the committee. I am happy to be here. I am Steve Greenwood, and I'm here representing the Oregon Solutions Program and the Columbia River Umatilla Solutions Task Force, affectionately known sometimes as the CRUST.
I want to give you a little background this morning about the efforts of this group, a little bit about its genesis, and where I think we're going to end up. I will mention here at the beginning that the group has not completed their work yet, and their last meeting, what we think is their last meeting, is going to be next week on the 18th. So with that disclaimer, I'll give you a little update on what they've been doing. And let me start with a little bit of the genesis of this. Last spring, Governor Kitzhaber designated this effort to enhance utilization of Columbia River water for farms and fish as an Oregon Solutions project. And it was done really in response to the tremendous economic opportunity in the Umatilla Basin, and also attempts over the last few legislative sessions to figure out a way to do that, that too often, I think, pitted irrigation interests against conservation interests. And Governor Kitzhaber asked Oregon Solutions to bring together a group of stakeholders that had broad representation to see what they could come up with as a consensus and offer to support recommendations that that group could generate through a consensus process. So, and before I talk about what they have come up with, I will mention two other things I think that influence the decision to try to do this. One is the state of Washington in 2006 passed a law to essentially do the same thing. So they're a little bit ahead of us, really. So they have an Office of the Columbia River Policy Advisory Group. And actually a fair amount of money that and staff that have been dedicated to the effort, and they've initiated over 49 projects over the last 6 years. And I can tell you more about that if you would like. But we've learned some lessons from them, and frankly, I think have been a little bit inspired by what they've been able to put together. The second thing is that the 2009 session approved the Umatilla Aquifer Recovery Project, which was in fact a collaborative effort that involved the tribes, conservation interests, and irrigation interests, local government, to try to put together an underground storage opportunity in the groundwater there. And there were some great relationships built that the governor felt that we could build upon in this larger effort. So last June, the governor's designated conveners, Richard Whitman, the natural resource advisor, and County Commissioner Dennis Doherty from Umatilla County, convened a group of 20 stakeholders that included irrigation interests, economic development interests, conservation interests, and state and federal agencies, and I might add, including a representative from the state of Washington and their program. And so we've been meeting over the last 5 months or so now, and the group has come up with a draft set of recommendations that I think we are all hopeful that they will approve, perhaps with some tweaks on the 18th. So I'm going to describe for you a little bit about the nature of those recommendations. First thing I would say is that there are really three general strategies that the group has coalesced around. The first one is to develop additional storage capacity so that we can store Columbia River water at times, mostly in the winter, when the fish don't need it, so that it can then be released and used for both fish and irrigators when they do need it in the late spring and summer months. The second strategy is really improved water management. That is, using the water more wisely, allowing it to be transferred from one user to another for the highest economic use, and also in terms of conservation. So really managing that water better. And the third, and what I think some would say is the most important part of this approach, is for Oregon
to take a more interstate approach to the planning and the management of Columbia River water, to work with our neighboring states of Idaho and Washington, to work with Canada, and actually through the Canadian treaty discussions, to see if there are opportunities, again, to provide mutual benefit for irrigators and for fish. I want to emphasize that these are all strategies, and we have some options that we have identified. We started with as large a range of options as we possibly could, to make sure that at the end of the day we didn't say, gee, you know, we never thought of that option. So we took a pretty broad scope to begin with. We had about 30 different options that we looked at. We screened at a, you know, relatively cursory level, but nevertheless, we took a look at each one of those options and then discussed and rated those options. And we've come up really with a list of about 11 that we think that there is some consensus to move forward with. That does not necessarily mean construction of certain things. It does mean, however, taking the next steps toward feasibility analysis, toward further negotiations, say, with the state of Washington, et cetera. The last piece of that, which I want to emphasize, which I think the Umatilla irrigators would say is maybe the most important part of this, is the establishment of a position in the Water Resources Department budget that would have a governing, you know, advisory committee that would again be broad-based, essentially taking the place of the current Columbia River Umatilla Solutions Task Force to oversee and carry through these recommendations in the future. That there's a lot of work still to be done, and I think that there is a consensus that we need something along the lines of a program like the state of Washington has. So that's one of the, I think, pretty strong recommendations from this group. So I want to emphasize again that the agenda or the recommendations that I think are going to be approved next Tuesday are consensus recommendations from all of the parties at the table, and I mean all of the parties at the table, and that have benefits for both irrigators and for fish. Again, I will emphasize that there's a lot more work to be done on these projects before we see water. But some of them are very short-term options. Some of them 1 to 2 years. Others can be done within 5 years. others will take much longer. Some of the large storage sites that are more likely to be in either Washington or Idaho, you know, they could take as much as 10 to 15 years to build, but they would provide as much as 1 million acre feet total for consumptive uses. So if there is a silver bullet, or are there any silver bullets here, it is really, frankly, in those large storage sites. And for the record, I want to add that the state of Washington's law and their program requires that when they're putting state money behind some of these projects, that fully one-third of the water stored and released has to stay in stream. And what that would mean is that if there were to be a large storage site in Washington, and they're working on some very specific ones that they're doing some initial studies on right now, but if that were to happen, that could be up to 250,000 acre feet released that would stay in stream, that would be a tremendous fish benefit in, say, July and August, when the fish really need it to head downstream to the Pacific Ocean. So again, I want to emphasize the dual benefits of this program. The last thing I want to say is that the group recognizes that the Umatilla Basin is not the only part of the state that has agricultural opportunities. We've talked about that a lot. We see this as perhaps one of the first major pieces of the kind of the geographic focused efforts out of the state's new integrated water strategy. And we have recognized that there are other folks in the state who have water needs as well.
Thank you for that addition. And thank you for your comments. Are there any questions?
I was going to say a couple of things. One is that I know this was a huge group, 32, 36?
20.
20 people?
It only felt like 36.
Okay. Maybe they're all doing double time. I don't know if you have a list there that you could read. You highlighted a couple of the different participants, but I thought it was a very impressive group. I went to the, at the Business Summit last week in Portland, I went to the presentation by this group, and it was very impressive. And the other thing I was going to say is that in the governor's new release budget, there's funding, and I just wondered if you could talk about how your group, when it moves forward and is able to come to agreements, might tap into funding that's being proposed or bonding that's being proposed through regional solutions,
right,
connected to Oregon solutions, for capital construction when people do get together and do this hard work. So if you could tie that together somehow.
Sure. Representative Kenny Geyer and members of the committee, first of all, I do have a list. Do you want me to read the list? What I might do is provide you a copy later of the list. I can give that to
you. If you provide the copy and mention your favorite member now.
Yeah, yeah. I'd like to decline to do that.
You know, there's actually some very strong environmental groups and irrigation groups. I mean, that's what I thought was impressive was the...
Yeah, I would just mention, on the conservation side, we have had Water Watch, Freshwater Trust, and the American Rivers Council all at the table. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it says something about our progress that a week ago, Water Watch made a presentation to the Oregon Business Council Leadership Summit. I'm not sure that that's happened before. So we have local government officials, as I mentioned before. We have a number of irrigators.
Tribes.
The Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation are certainly there. And then we have, as I said before, the State of Washington's program is represented, as well as certainly state agencies, Oregon Water Resources Department, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the Oregon Department of Agriculture. So I'd be happy to get you a list of, and in fact, what I would like to do also, this group, we hope, will be we'll be signing a declaration of cooperation that outlines all of this and their consensus agreement at the next meeting. So once that's done, I'd be happy to make that declaration of cooperation available to the members of the committee.
Thank you for that.
And
the second question was about the
budget.
Construction bonds.
There are some budget needs that have been identified in this in these recommendations. Again, these are draft, so they've not been signed off by the whole group yet. But one of them, and probably again, in many people's minds, the most important is funding for a staff position to oversee this effort to really help Oregon take this interstate approach going forward.
In the Water Resources Department, is that what you had
mentioned? That would be in the Water Resources Department budget. That is correct. The second item is money to do additional feasibility studies and what's called appraisal level studies for some of these storage sites. When we were up recently to the State of Washington's policy advisory group, one of the things that they advised us is, you know, have some money to actually back up this effort or you won't make much progress. Now, they frankly have had a lot more money than what we will probably be able to put together at this time, but they felt that money to actually do these studies, because you never know all the details until you actually take a closer look at some of these potential storage sites, what some of the issues are. The last thing is related to actual financing of construction, and we're probably a ways away at this point from actual construction of storage facilities. We know that there will be a proposal that's a statewide proposal, not specific to the Umatilla Basin, from the Water Resources Department for some bonding authority for water development projects. And while the group has not come to a consensus about any specific amount for any specific project, they have recognized that there is going to be a need for financing of some of these projects. And just to keep in mind that, you know, in all cases, the construction of those kinds of projects ends up getting translated into water rates then that the water users for consumptive use would end up paying over time for the use of that water.
Question answered?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Greenwood. Any other comments before we dismiss Mr. Greenwood? That's our last witness. Okay. Thank you for your presentation very much. Colleagues, thank you for your patience today. I thought all three subjects were very important. I do note there is something on here to give you the opportunity on legislative concepts, since we've already sort of gone through those without a lot of explanation but approval. There are no other concepts. I'll move on. The last thing I want to say is about the committee. Before I do, I noticed that Palmer Mason is here. Palmer, do you have an announcement about the withdrawal of the governor's 10-year energy plan? If not,
no, nothing there.
Okay.
Or withdrawal of clean fuels or, you know, some little thing like that.
It's a long list, but no draws.
Okay. I love Palmer. He's a good man. We may disagree once in a while, but he's a good man. It's just that I wanted to say how much I've enjoyed this experience. I particularly want to thank Christy for her work keeping things moving and making the important recording of everything that we talk about. So thank you for your help. And I want to thank each member. What an honor to be co-chair of a committee with this kind of firepower and experience. Starting with being on the committee with Chair Cannon, and then going to co-chair with Ben Cannon, who I have a great deal of respect for, then to co-chair with Jules Bailey, who's got more ideas floating around in that unbelievable head of his. I can't hardly keep up. I was glad he wasn't here today. he's been a great co-chair, and that whole experience of 30-30, I think, was particularly a good thing for energy, environment, and water. And now we move on, and we will continue to work together because of the relationships, I think, that we've built. But each and every one of you have contributed to this committee. We can hardly call you a rookie anymore, and you demonstrated what a quick study you are again today. So we're glad that you've been on the committee. And moving on to Representative Benz, I never like to say something nice in front of him, so I'm glad he's gone. But what a powerhouse he's been. He does his homework. When I'm stuck wondering what in the world is this about and we're about to start, I go to him first. I already said something, and I'll mention it again about Representative Boone. Not on just coastal issues, but her work. She's always giving me unbelievable articles and resources on energy that I never knew existed. And you're truly an international expert on energy issues, and I'm so glad to have served with you on this committee as well. And moving on down, I have to say something about my vice chair, who urges me to get here earlier in the morning because he's here early and he's a hard worker, and he understands these issues so well as well. And I'm very pleased that I got to serve with you. And Representative Witt, you're one of the good guys. You're one of the guys that reaches across the aisle, and what a pleasure to serve with you. And Representative Thompson, I serve with him on both my committees, Human Resources. He's a rock.
And a joy it is.
And I knew he'd say that. And, you know, he is kind of a sage grouse.
I love it.
So, and I will have to say that when Representative Benz was describing the sage grouse, saying, what did he say, there are millions of acres and very few of them, we might want to trade our moniker of an elephant for a sage grouse, the way things are going. But I'm sure the party will make me pay for that comment. And last, but certainly not least, you've heard a lot today about Beth Petrino because of her hard work. And Beth, we appreciate so much what you've done. You have made it a joy to be on this committee. You've made it possible for us to get through incredibly complex issues. You have worked beautifully as a the right person for a co-chair experience in a very complex committee. And your professionalism and work is to be respected and to be appreciated.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
With that, there are no other comments.
I'd like to say something.
Please.
I'm going to miss you. Representative Gilliam has been a good friend, a good chair, and in some of these issues when they get tense and a little contentious sometimes, he keeps the levity going, and he's very fair. And I think everybody who's, we have a group here, some of you are the usual suspects who are here constantly, and I think you would agree. He's been an excellent chair, and I'd like to congratulate you on retaining that position next. I wasn't supposed to say it. I hope that you will be continuing in this committee because you have a lot to add. And you know what I really hope for you in the end of the day is that we will get that fuel cell thing going.
Excellent. Thank you for those comments. Well, regarding next session, Representative Kotek, the speaker designate elect, however we call that, sent out that little, email. What committees do you want? My first choice was to be chair of Senate Environment. And there's no word back on that yet.
Get some support from some of the Democrats for that.
Okay, with that, thank you all, and we are adjourned.